XS number 9282, reel 6.
Lady Corbett, reel 6.
Well, now here we are. I'm flying into Singapore, and Jean Big is coming down by boat. And we were able to get to Singapore in time to meet her. And she gave me the rotor arm of my Jeep. So I drove my Jeep off the boat and put her in it. And off we went to into Singapore. And Jean said, I think we'd better go to Raffles Hotel because that's the only place I know in Singapore. And lo and behold, we went to Raffles Hotel. And what does Jean Begg do but grab Raffles Hotel for the YWCA? And she goes to the CO of the area and says, there's all those women and children in Java and Sumatra, and I've been talking to Lady Louis Mountbatten, and she's quite willing to have the women come back to Singapore, but she wants somewhere to put them when they come back here. Can we please have Raffles Hotel as a reception centre for women and children who've been in custody with the Japanese in Java and Sumatra? So we got Raffles Hotel. No trouble to Jean Begg to get Raffles Hotel, the best hotel in the East. And we know every room in Raffles Hotel. And actually, one of the strange things is that when we took over Raffles Hotel and we were looking around it, the room which the last time I was in Singapore was the office of BOAC, when we first saw it, was full of Japanese torture machinery. And the torture machinery hadn't yet been moved, but this big room, which became the offices of BOAC in Singapore, and I think still are, were full of Japanese torture machines. Terrible things.
Could you describe a few of them?
Oh, they seem to be a whole series of pulleys and springs and weights and, oh, horrible things. Oh, just terrible things. Who they'd obviously used them, but on whom, I don't know, fortunately. So our best story is using Raffles Hotel as a reception centre for women and children who'd been in custody in Java and Sumatra. And a lot of those women were English women who'd lived and worked in Singapore, and their husbands were taken off by the Japanese to either Changi Prison, which is in Singapore, or up to Japan itself as prisoners of war. And obviously they wanted to get in touch with wives with husbands, husbands with wives. And the Red Cross turned up too. They were very good indeed. The Red Cross did a fantastic job on finding husbands and wives who had been prisoners of war. And they used Raffles Hotel as their headquarters. And these women and children began to turn up from Singapore, from Java and Sumatra. And Jean Begg said to Lady Louis, who was also in Singapore at that time, do you think you could find two members of my staff named Leela Bridgman and another member of staff who had been on the YWCA staff in Malaya? And lo and behold, one day, they both turned up. And one of them, Audrey Owen, who's written one of the bits in Jean Begg's book, Audrey Owen was the wife of an engineer with whom my husband had served. And these two men served in Malaya together. And lo and behold, one day, Audrey's husband came striding on the front door of Raffles Hotel because he had heard that Jean Begg was somewhere around about. And he knew that he'd only had to find Jean Begg, and Jean Begg would have found Audrey. So there was Audrey, and there was the husband, and there was JB, and here was Leela Bridgman. And Jean only had to ask Lady Louis, would she please find these two and bring them back? So they did. And Lady Louis was very good indeed to us.
What was your impression of the women and children coming into Raffles?
Oh, they were starving. They had been very badly treated by the Japanese, and only by careful management had they managed to succeed. And also, they were very careful indeed not to ask for too much. No, don't. We had a lot of stuff. And also the Australian Red Cross sent in a mercy ship full of the most wonderful things, like dressing gowns and jackets and anything and everything, from a reel of cotton to anything. And the English woman said, no, don't give me a whole reel of cotton. I only need about a foot, please. Don't give me a packet of needles. I only want one needle, thank you. And they had been in custody with an awful lot of Dutch. And the Dutch were dreadful. They grabbed and grabbed and grabbed and grabbed everything. And there was one lot of mercy things being given out there, and another lot being given out there, and another lot being given out there. And these Dutch women went to all three and just grabbed. But the English women never. They, no, I don't need that. And fortunately, some of the things that had been sent on this Australian mercy ship were children's clothes. And the mother said, no, just give me one pair of trousers. That'll last him until he gets to England. No, don't give me two. I only want one, thanks. And they were marvellous. And you see, all the time in custody, what little they had, they shared. But the Dutch just grabbed everything. They were terrible. I've never liked the Dutch since then. Even now I could hardly like the Dutch. But they really were, they were dreadful. And I think it's just a national characteristic, but under those sort of circumstances. But I have full admiration of all the English women. And they really were, they were marvellous. Well, I'll cut that story short.
Did you have to offer much emotional support after those awful experiences that they've been through?
No, not really. The Red Cross was there and they were doing that. Now, we just sort of frightfully busy. We had an awful job getting things. I took some sheets down to the Navy ship one day and got some bread from them because we had no bread. See, the Raffles had no food at all. The Japanese cleaned out their things and, oh no. And then we were trying to get tins of tomato juice and vitamin B because they all had sprue. They were all suffering from vitamin B deficiencies. And they needed things like, you know, jams and tomato juice and fresh fruits and all those sorts of things. So we were looking after them physically, so to speak. And they had a lot of friends amongst themselves because they'd made very good friends. And they were sticking together now until their husbands and people turned up or until they were rehabilitated back to England or wherever they'd come from, or they found out whether their husbands were still alive or whether they weren't, and that sort of thing. And it was a very good piece of work, the YWCA. We were providing with residents, and the Red Cross was providing them with comforts and that sort of thing. And the Red Cross were doing a register of the home addresses and, you know, that sort of thing. And it was a very, very good piece of work that was done there. And then that all got sorted out. And round the corner we found another little hotel which we grabbed from the RAF, and that we set up as a services club. And we gave up Raffles after a while and had this club round the corner which was very good as a services club. But in the meantime, we had to go to Hong Kong. So off we went to Hong Kong, me with my Jeep. Me and my Jeep went on a DC-3 with... Now, Iris Stobart I sent for. She turned up after a while. Some other member of staff I took up there. And again, we found a building. And again, we furnished it. And again, we established a club. And again, when that was established and really working well, off we went to Japan because we were the occupation forces in Japan, and did a fantastic job. The YWCA War Services did a fantastic job in Japan.
What did you actually set up in Japan?
Well, first of all, I wasn't in the beginning of this. Muriel Wilson went there, and at Itajima, which was the naval headquarters of the Japanese Navy, the YWCA took over buildings. Itajima, ETA. Jima, J-I-M-A. That was the naval headquarters of the headquarters of the Navy. And Muriel set up a wonderful drop-in club. And then she got a whole series of little Japanese houses in Kure, which is only a few miles from Hiroshima. The bomb had only just been dropped. And set up this lovely residential club and these chattering and charming little Japanese girls as house girls. Oh, they were sweet. Everybody had their own personal servants. And when General MacArthur got to Japan, he said to the medical missionaries there, the ABM again, American Baptist Mission, what can we do for Japan? And the missionaries said, employ every woman you possibly can, because a Japanese woman has never had any money in all her life. Employ all the Japanese women you can, give them everybody a job if you can. Get everybody, let them have two or three servants and give them a bit of money. And then that will be the beginnings of the revival of Japan. And it was. Everybody had, you had your own little house. And you had a cook and you had a gardener and you had a housemaid. I don't think you could employ a sewing woman each, or you had a sewing woman for two or three. And they got money for the first time in their lives.
But what did they do with their children to enable them to be free to work?
Oh, well, they'd leave them with grandma. It was very much the family sort of system, where the villages they came from. Children were no problem at all. If a woman could go and get some money by earning it, it meant it was, she took it back to the whole village back there. And it was wonderful. And you see, now the Japanese Diet, which is the parliament, has got more women in it than any other parliament in the world. And this is all because those American Baptist Mission women said to General MacArthur, if you want to do something for Japan, do it through the women. Employ every woman you can. And everybody had a personal servant. Be blown to having a male in the house. Oh, no, they're arrogant, horrible people. In those days, they're better now. But they were arrogant, horrible, nasty men that just put their thumbs down on any and every woman. And also, in the old regime, any Japanese woman was forbidden under any circumstance to reprove a male person under any circumstances. A mother couldn't reprove a son. A wife couldn't reprove a husband. A husband wouldn't talk to his sister. And that was the old system. And the Japanese men gave their wives nothing. They gave them no housekeeping money, no nothing. She was only there to be a servant and to have his bath ready for him when he came home at night. No women were so badly treated as the Japanese women were pre-war. None of them. And so, but when these occupation forces came in and employ the women, give them some money, and we used to say to the little girls, sweeties, what you do with your money? Baba, baba. Always, you know, any woman would spend her money on her children. And that really worked out very well. And all over Japan, and we had a very nice club, a drop-in club in Tokyo. We had one in Kobe. We had one in Kyoto. And always the Japanese women we employed. And we employed Japanese women as the cooks too. We wouldn't have any men around the place.
How did their men react to the fact that their women weren't at home any longer to care for them?
I'll be blowed to them. You know, the Japanese women got the message. And the men got the message too. Because, you see, a Japanese man would never deign to clean anything. And we had stuck with Japanese dirt from Imphal in India, right through Malaya, into Singapore, into Hong Kong, and right into Japan, and there's nothing dirtier than Japanese dirt. It stinks. The building we got in Hong Kong was the Japanese legation building, and it took 27 coolies 2 weeks to clean the dirt out of the basement. And they, Chinese coolies, and they really worked, and they weren't Japanese. But no Japanese man would soil his hands by doing any work. And so the dirt just accumulated. It was incredible, the dirt. And, you know, we went to Japan with the hatred of the Japanese in our hearts, but we immediately found it wasn't the Japanese that we hated, it was the Japanese men who were spoiled brats. Every Japanese man, from the lowest to the highest, had been brought up a spoiled brat. And you know how they behave. You're a mother, you know, spoiled boys can behave. Well, this was a nation. It was incredible. But the moment we had these Japanese women, and everybody had the Japanese women, let me tell you about the marriage system. A Japanese woman was betrothed to a Japanese man almost at birth. And she never had any education or anything. She was just the girl about the house. And when she was marriageable age, which was quite young, 15, 16 or 17, something like that, she went off to the house of her husband. And a Japanese woman wore white three times in her life. She wore white when she was born, she wore white when she died, and she wore white, the outside kimono white, when she was married, for the reason that she was dead to her former family and married to the new family. And a Japanese husband with a young bride could forbid his wife ever to see her family again. And at the age of about 30, 35, the moment a young bride came into her house, a Japanese woman changed completely. She became an old harrigan, and she ordered this little girl around. She didn't think of what had happened to her when she was that age. She changed completely, and she was an absolute bitter enemy, and she just treated this young bride as a servant. And yet she had been through that process, and her mother had been through the process before that, but this was the system. It's all changed now, thank goodness. Thank goodness. But it really started off in the days of the occupation when the American missionaries said to General MacArthur, pay the women for doing something, give them money. And they weren't paid much, but it was more than they'd ever had before. And they worked for us very willingly, and until they came and asked us, could they go planting the rice? So they had to go home. The women's job was to plant the rice. You know how hard work that is, bending your back and planting rice. Men didn't plant rice, women did. Women did all the hard work. But they're quite different now. The Japanese have come round now to be quite decent people. And the Japanese woman now will choose whom she marries. And a Japanese woman will go to a proper school and university and have a proper education. Doing very well. So that worked out very well. And I think we almost need to stop soon. Shall we finish off the reel? How much more is there? Well, of course, the thing that really meant most to me was that I met my present husband in Calcutta. I didn't marry him for another 20 years, but he's very much the man in my life, and I've never have met him, and I've never have had the opportunity of coming to England and to marry a baronet and to be here in comfortable circumstances. So that's what the war really meant to me. But also, I had the opportunity of controlling so many people, was running so many clubs in so many places. That was the reason why I was given the job and being in charge of the girls' borstal in New Zealand. And then later on, I became the governor of the women's prison. And I did that for 15 years. After I went home to New Zealand, I decided not to go back onto a laboratory bench to work on a laboratory bench, but to work with women and children, with women. And I was the governor of the girls' borstal and the governor of a women's prison for 15 years. And then Sir John came to New Zealand and we got married, and here I am here. So that's really what the war meant to me.
And your career in retrospect in the YWCA?
Oh, enjoyed every minute. I had a job to do, so we did it. And it was a very interesting job because, you see, you had to use all the initiative you had. And New Zealanders have got plenty of initiative. Very much, and you used your initiative always over everything. And there you were. And then also, of course, you learnt to cope with all sorts of circumstances. In this country you had men servants, and in that country you had women servants, and in that country you didn't have any at all, and somewhere else you couldn't never get any wood to make anything with, and somewhere such as in Burma, here we suddenly, this beautiful wood turned up, and we thought all our, thought this was quite wonderful, suddenly to find a place where you really could. And also, the further east you go, the better the workmen are. The Egyptians are pretty poor. The Indians aren't much better. The Malayans are not bad. But the moment you get to China, you get these Chinese who marry their heads and their hands together, and they're wonderful. Chinese men and women, they're really quite fantastic because they can do anything. And as for the Japanese, I went to Japan 20 years later, and they've improved a lot, but they're not up to the Chinese, in my opinion. At least that's not my experience of them. But I don't have any experience of the modern Japanese businessmen, because I've had no... I went back to Japan just before I married Sir John. I was away for 20 years and went back there for 3 or 4 months. And I was teaching in the United Nations Institute for the Treatment of Offenders in Tokyo. I had an extra 3 months in Tokyo doing that. And then I came back to New Zealand, and Sir John and I got married, and he brought me here. So that's my career.
You were going to tell me about a bazaar.
Yes, Cox's Bazaar. Yes. You know the geography of India. Calcutta's up at the top of a big gulf, and it comes down the Arakan, and then it goes round to Rangoon. That's the geography of that part of the world. Well, down in Cox's Bazaar, which is on the Arakan, which is on a beautiful coastline with a beautiful beach, there were suddenly 3 or 4 South African hospitals. Because there were a lot of South African troops and a lot of American troops sent down there, straight down from Chittagong, straight south down the Arakan, and these hospitals were going to be sent down into the middle of the bush. Terrible conditions. And we decided we'd better have a club. And so I was sent down to find somewhere to have a club, and the only thing we could do was we chopped the top off a hill. And we chopped the top off this hill and we built the club. It was built in bamboo and thatch.
How on earth did you manage to chop the top off?
We got the engineers to get the men to. It was always the Royal Engineers that did these sort of things. And we had Lady Louis come down to open it. And I've got a letter here from Lady Louis. Shall I read it onto the tape? Is there room? Let me give you this letter, and maybe your museum, I'd like to have a copy of it. I'd like the original back, please. But it shows you how even people like Lady Louis were impressed with this work of the British YWCA War Services.
Right, have you anything else to add?
Oh, I could go on for several more tapes, but I think that's just about all we've... I really wanted to bring in the Cox's Bazaar because it was an unusual way of having a club, to chop the top off a hill and build the club on top of a hill and then have everybody come there. And Lady Louis came down and opened it for us. And she seemed to appreciate it very much. And we appreciated her visit, of course.
Were there any other particular difficulties in setting up that club other than having to... take the top off of a hill?
Well, every club has its difficulties, but every club has its difficulties to be overcome. And we overcame all the difficulties one after the other, whether it was in the jungle somewhere or on the top of a hill or out in the desert or wherever these women were sent to live, we turned up to support them and help them. And we enjoyed doing it, and they enjoyed us too. And they, wherever they came, they always found, comfort and relaxation. And we hope a nice-looking place, clean, good meals, clean beds. That was the service we were able to offer. And it all started because Mrs. Churchill asked my aunt, Jean Begg, to fly from India and take charge of these recreational activities of women in uniform. Way back in 1939, the end of 1939, beginning of 1940, and we finished up in Japan 1947. And we spent 7 years going from Cairo to Tokyo, and other members of our staff went from Cairo to Italy and from Cairo to Tripoli. So we, in the end, we had a series of clubs going from Tripoli to Japan. And then wherever possible, we handed over, when we finished, we handed over our equipment to the local YWCA. In Rangoon, this furniture we made there, we handed to the Rangoon YWCA, and I'm sure it's probably still in use there because it was good furniture. And wherever we could, we gave what equipment we had to the local Y, which would help them to use it and help them in their work. And they helped us, of course. Wherever we went, if there was a local YWCA, we got in touch with them, and they helped us tremendously about getting staff and giving us what you did in the local regimes and the way in which you did that.
How far did you have contact with the Red Cross and the WVS?
All the other ones. Well, these women came and stayed in our clubs, and particularly the heads of the Red Cross and the WVS and the Fannies and the Saffers and all these people, they were always moving around because they had the same area as Jean Begg had, but not quite from here to there. And wherever there was a YWCA, they always came and stayed with us because they knew we were a good, clean place and we'd look after them properly. And if there was a problem turned up, if we didn't able to help with it, then we'd refer it to